Hey everyone, welcome to Secure AF, the podcast about all things cybersecurity. I'm your host, Teddy Underkoffler. Today I'm joined with co-host Jonathan Kimmett.
Hello everybody.
As well as our special guest for the episode today, Brian Kontos.
Hi everybody. Thanks Teddy. Thanks Jonathan for having me on.
Absolutely. We are thrilled to have you on the episode. Today, we are going to be talking about IoT and OT threats and trends, as well as what the term XIoT means for the industry and professionals. But before we get into that, Brian, do you mind telling us a little bit about who you are and kind of your history?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in cybersecurity for a little over 25 years. I started my career with DISA, the Defense Information Systems Agency, down in Fort Huachuca. After a couple of years, I actually moved to Brazil and worked for Bell Labs for a couple of years after that. But once I made it back to the States, I just started building startups or helping to build startups. It wasn't just me, of course. But a number of companies, RipTech, ArcSight, Imperva, McAfee, Celera Networks, Cylance, Jask, Veridin was my last company, and we actually sold that to Mandiant and then Google. And currently, I'm a board advisor with an XIoT security company called Phosphorus. During that time, I wrote a couple books. I wrote my last book with the former deputy director of the NSA, Bill Kroll. And a few years back, I did a cyber war documentary with the former head of the NSA and the CIA, which was a lot of fun. That was called Five Eyes, and that was with General Michael Hayden. But yeah, I've traveled all over the world. I've worked in about 50 countries, six continents, never hit Antarctica, not yet. Not a lot of penguins looking for cybersecurity these days. But it's been a lot of fun. So I've definitely learned a lot of what not to do and what doesn't work in security. And because of all those mistakes, it kind of helped me learn actually what to do that works. So here I am and happy to share anything I can with your listeners today.
Awesome. No, that sounds great. So glad you could make it today. Getting into the subject of the episode, before we kind of start to talk about trends and threats, let's just go ahead and define what is IoT, what is OT, and what is XIoT?
Yeah, absolutely. So XIoT stands for Extended Internet of Things. And it's kind of a marketing term, but really it's a nice catch-all because there's about three categories that make up XIoT. The first one is enterprise IoT, things that we typically, I think about intuitively when we think about IoT. These are printers, security cameras, door locks, lights out management, KVM switches, voice over IP phones, all those smart devices that you see around the office and sometimes at home. So there certainly is overlap. The second category is OT. These are SCADA devices or industrial control system devices. These are essentially digital equipment that controls physics, voltage, flow, temperature, volume. You find them a lot in batch and discrete manufacturing, power and energy, oil and gas, transportation, sanitation, you name it, anything where that physical world sort of has to be managed. And the last one, and this is one that is oftentimes overlooked, but I'll tell you why it falls into the same group. These are network devices, things like wireless access points, network attached storage, layer two switches, load balancers. Because collectively, what all these quote unquote smart devices have in common is, first off, they're network connected almost always. Sometimes on the OT side for the older stuff, maybe they're separated, but that's still pretty rare today. So they're network connected. The second thing is they have purpose-built hardware and software. So I have a security camera. It's probably not going to print. It's probably not going to be a phone. It's going to do one thing. It's going to be a security camera. I have a printer. It's going to do that specific thing. I have an OT device. It's going to control flow of oil or something of that nature. So they're purpose-built. But the third and probably most important for this conversation is you can't install any kind of endpoint security. You're not going to put EDR or anti-malware or a firewall or IPS on a voice over IP phone. You're just not going to do it. It's not going to allow it. There are some cases where you can go to a manufacturer and put on what might be called like a nano agent. And that's such a small portion of the market. I hesitate to even mention it, but that is a possibility. But the thing about it is, even though there's these specialized devices where you can't install security, they're all pretty much Linux servers. They're running Ubuntu, they're running BusyBox or some variant like Android. On the network side, a lot of times it's BSD. And on the OT side, it's real-time operating systems like VxWorks, which are a little bit more obscure, but not really in the industry. So they're popular operating systems, and sometimes more capable hardware, you know, in terms of processing, memory, and storage than your laptop. I've seen cameras that are way more powerful than my laptop, for example, but they're not secure. So it's kind of a perfect storm for bad actors, right? Because you're saying, well, wow, I've got all these little Linux servers. Why don't I just try to hack into them instead of the database or the web server or the laptop? So it really kind of changes how we think about the attack surface.
Brian, let me ask you, coming from, you know, I've got a help desk background and I've been in security for, I don't know, a long time. But I know a lot of people, when we get into this conversation about IoT and OT, one of the, maybe the confusion or maybe the naive notion, I guess, is that these are just computers. You know, you take maybe an organization doesn't have an IT security professional. They just have IT people. And maybe not even a lot. Maybe they have a small IT team. And they're thinking like, well, these are just computers. They got a MAC address. They get on the network. Why do I have to think about them differently? So could you talk a little bit specifically from that point of view? Because I think that mindset is out there. And I think a lot of people just, they go, yeah, that's just a computer. We're just hooking on the network. And then they kind of forget about it. So what's your thoughts on that in terms of those organizations?
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. They definitely do forget about it. And I'll share some interesting research with you around that. So we spent about the last 5 years doing research into production level XIoT devices. So we didn't take like a camera and pull out the hardware and get an oscilloscope and dig into the hardware and say, hey, there's a vulnerability here. That there's plenty of people that are doing great research in that area. That's fine. What we wanted to say is, what's it like once these devices get out in the wild? How much of a threat do they pose? And sort of what's the footprint? So a couple interesting things came out of this. And again, we looked at thousands of companies over 5 years, millions and millions of devices. So there's no one specific type or vendor or geo or vertical that's called out here. The first one was the sheer volume. And I didn't realize this going in. I don't think any of us expected the number to be as high. But there's about 3 to 5 XIoT devices per employee in an enterprise. So if you have a company of about 10,000 people, that's 30 to 50,000 devices. Now, when we go into an organization, we say, hey, before we start, you know, looking into this, how many devices do you think you have? Almost on the button, they're always off by 40 to 60%. So if they say, oh, Brian, we think we have, I don't know, maybe 10,000. Well, I know they have at least 20. Because they go, oh, we forgot about all the door locks. Oh, we didn't know we were counting switches. So there's this notion that, first of all, most organizations don't even know what they have. And as we know from a security perspective, usually job one is know what you got. If you're going to try to secure it. So that's a big problem we see. And the other problems we see beyond that, I like to call 1995 security issues. And Jonathan, being on the help desk side and the security side, I'm sure you've seen a lot of these in the past, but kind of what that means is just take the basics like passwords. So simple credentials. 50% of the time, the passwords are the default credentials that you can Google and figure out in just a few moments. The other 50%, generally speaking, those passwords were changed once, and that was the time at installation. And if you think about the parameters around installing these devices, let's take a simple example. Let's take security cameras because it's very intuitive and everybody's familiar with those. Some team shows up with a van and a bunch of boxes of cameras and a drill, and they're mounting these things to the walls and they're wiring up the fiber optics and they're connecting it to some closed caption system, for example. We're in organizations today where we see people with tens and tens of thousands of security cameras. Well, they're not thinking about security development lifecycle. Yeah. They're not thinking about best practices. They're thinking, I need to bolt this to the wall so it doesn't fall off and it needs to be able to talk to something. And once that's done, I'm moving on to the next one. So if there is a password, usually, again, it's default or it's very bad. So forget about best practices. Let's rotate the passwords every 90 days. Let's use special characters, upper, lowercase, and numbers. Let's make sure it's at least 15 characters long. Forget it. None of that stuff is happening. And that's not just cameras, that's across all of these devices. So we see a lot of that. And again, if you find a device that's internet connected, you can use Shodan and very quickly identify, you know, probably today, if you went to Shodan and typed in, you know, security camera, just camera or something, I'm guessing you'd get somewhere between 4 and 6 million hits, right?
Yeah.
So that's the first, passwords, right? Pretty easy. The next one is, we find out that a lot of these devices are running really old firmware. And again, sometimes they're being installed with old firmware because, again, it works and nobody thinks to upgrade it before it gets installed. But the average age that we see in the field is about 6 years. So we've all got a smartphone. Think about your smartphone trying to operate if the OS was 6 years old or if app was. It probably wouldn't even work, to be honest, in the smartphone world. But these XIoT devices often have very old firmware. In fact, about a quarter, about 25%, run with end-of-life firmware. So it's not even supported anymore. So what does old firmware come with? A bunch of vulnerabilities. And this is the one that really threw my hair back, because if you think about it, 50% of these devices I don't need to really even hack into. I can simply log into because it's the default password. And probably another 20, 25%, I can guess the password pretty easily, what it was changed to. But the ones I can't, because they have old firmware, they're running with very high level vulnerabilities. So level 8, 9, and 10 vulnerabilities make up about 75% of the attack surface on these devices. So if I can't log into it with a default password, there's a pretty good chance I can exploit it. And then let's multiply that again. I might have 30 to 50,000 of these little Linux servers running in my environment, which creates this massive security risk. So again, I call it 1995 security, because we're saying, one, find out what you got. Two, make sure you're managing the credentials well, maybe even integrating with a PAM tool, a privileged access management tool, something like a HashiCorp, Thycotic, or CyberArk, for example. Patch your device, right? I mean, I know this is a crazy idea, patch your devices. And then two little things that kind of are stragglers in the back end. The certs on these things are atrocious. They're self-signed. They're TLS 1.1 or 1.2. They're cryptologically unsafe. They're expired almost always, especially on wireless access points. I don't know why, but they're always expired. And the other thing is hardening. So for example, I might be running these devices like a printer, for example. They're the most promiscuous devices in the world because they want everybody to print from them. Use my paper, use my ink. So you can connect wire and wireless and Bluetooth and over HTTP and HTTPS and Telnet and TFTP and FTP and SSH. And it's just like, connect to me. And that's great from a usage perspective. And I want to make it easy for the users, but it's also fantastic from an attacker's perspective, right? And how they're able to get in. So again, harden the device, manage the certs, manage the creds, update the firmware, and please, discover what you got. And that seems like such a simple one, but the discovery tools that we've used historically, nothing was really designed for XIoT. It's more IT focused. So it's definitely not the fault of the enterprise. There just weren't the tools in the past to actually tell you, here's all your stuff.
Right. You know, and I think a lot of it is, and this comes from my previous organizations, ones that I've worked with and worked at, IoT devices are not installed by IT. You know, a lot of times facilities are installing, you know, the water meters that have a network connection, or the sprinkler control system, or, you know, a variety of things. It's not IT installing them, you know. Yeah. So it's and that kind of actually leads to a question that popped up when you were the last little bit you were saying. When we talk about liability, I mean, these are computers and they're on the network. But when you're talking about liability of the risks, do you think that there will be a time, maybe in the near future, that organizations who sell these devices with unpatched firmware or not patched firmware, or not able to be patched firmware, do you think that liability is going to change? I mean, I can definitely see it from a cybersecurity perspective that, you know, if I was providing a cybersecurity insurance plan for an organization for these devices, my question would be, well, do your devices get regular updates? I mean, we do that for laptops and desktops and various other things. And if they don't, I'm not sure I would actually, cover them for insurance premiums.
Yeah, you're thinking in exactly the right direction too. One thing I'll say first before diving deeper into it is, responsibility of actual maintaining these devices as well as installation. It's remember the end of Spider-Man, the multiverse, where you had all the different Spider-Man and they're pointing at each other, who's Spider-Man, who's Spider-Man?
Right.
That's what it kind of is when you say, hey, who's responsible for these devices? Oh, it's network ops. No, it's not us. It's facilities. It's security.
Yeah.
No, we're outsourcing it to a third-party vendor. So nobody wants to take responsibility. And right. I don't blame them, because the old days of managing these things was you had to have a football team full of people with paper clips to hit the little reset button,
yes,
thumb drive, and sit there for an hour for each device updating it. Blech. Again, multiply that by 50,000 devices. That's not a very fun thing to do. So it was very manual and chaotic. So there's that portion. But back to sort of the meat of your question in terms of liability, I absolutely think vendors need to step up. Now, we've been saying this in the SCADA space, in the industrial control system side, for a long time. And it's almost like, well, if organizations aren't asking for more secure devices, we're not going to provide more secure devices. Because if we provide more secure devices at a higher cost, they're not willing to pay. That's starting to change. But again, it's taken decades for that to really evolve in the OT space. I hoped that we would have learned in the kind of broader XIoT world from what we did in IT, and we would have gotten in front of this, but we didn't. And what we're seeing, and this is the really sad part, is there's a lot of shared libraries and white labeling in this space. And if you just think about the magnitude of the space, I'll just use a little comparison here. Think about the number of servers in the cloud, not talking virtual machines, but physical servers. There's probably about 15 million. So think of that as maybe like the number of horses we have in the world. And then if you think about the number of devices that have keyboards, traditional laptops, workstations, there's probably right around 5 to 8 billion of those, right? So kind of the number of people, so horses to people. Now we think about the number of XIoT devices. There's about 50 billion, or roughly the number of birds. So it's exponentially higher than these other two groups combined. So because of that, there's a lot of vendors manufacturing these tools. And some of these vendors are not high-tech companies. They're not tech companies in any way, shape, or form. They might be an agricultural company that has a specific device that's used to measure moisture in soil or something like that. Or they might be a telephone company, but having a smart voice over IP phone isn't really their focus. So they outsource that to contractors with no idea of security development lifecycle or secure best practices or how to make secure code. And what happens is they're borrowing code from here and white labeling this little bit and smushing it together because they're incentivized to get it up and running as fast as they can, get it to market with as many cool blinky lights and buttons as possible. And this all kind of came to head in about 2016, there was a sort of the grandfather of all XIoT attacks was called Mirai. And Mirai was what I call a legacy attack. It's a very old school attack, which was predicated on turning devices into botnets. But what it did is somebody went on Shodan, for example, or some other location. They said, hey, tell me all the security cameras that are online. And it says, okay, here's a bunch. Okay. In addition to that, tell me the ones that are running port 23, Telnet. Okay. Then kind of shrinks it down to this list. Once I find that number of devices, I see, okay, which ones of these can I log in with default passwords or sort of common passwords, like maybe the top 10 or so common passwords. With just that simple capability, find me cameras that are running Telnet with no passwords or default passwords, what can I log into? And it turns out millions of devices. And the way Mirai worked is it logged onto these cameras. It was able to install malware. And then bad actors were able to control these cameras, spy on people, record audio, record video, a whole number of things. But it didn't stop there. Because what happened is the same code and default passwords and vulnerabilities and open ports that were built into that camera were also used on printers and set-top boxes and phones and different types of network gear because everybody had shared everything. So the attackers behind Mirai said, wow, I don't just have a botnet of cameras now. I can have a botnet of all these XIoT devices, all these little Linux servers. And at one point, the Mirai botnets actually had a combined operating bandwidth and processing power, more than Google and Amazon combined, right? So these are really powerful botnets. And this is back in 2016. Well, fast forward till today, 2023, what we're seeing is there's still devices out there deployed today, because we talked about the old firmware, that are still vulnerable to Mirai. And beyond that, because no one's really paying attention to these devices, there are still devices in production enterprise environments that are compromised by Mirai. They're actually running the malware, and they have been since 2016 or 2017, right? So that's kind of that perfect storm. And I do feel there has to be a little bit more security savviness from the vendor side and how they do this. But in order for that to happen, the users are going to have to demand it. Now, yeah, there's a number of attacks we can talk about as well that I think is actually starting to push this to the forefront now, as nation states and cyber criminals are really starting to prey on XIoT. Because why worry about firewalls and endpoint security and application security, identity management, when I can just log into a printer or access a camera and then do that to expand throughout your network and do malicious things? So they're starting to take that back door. I think that's going to make organizations say, hey, I need a camera, but man, that thing's got to be safe. I got to be able to update it. I've got to be able to make sure it's got solid cert. And if you can't provide that, I'm going to look at vendor B that might be providing that for me. So the tail will start to wag the dog, and we'll kind of get to where we need to be. Doesn't happen overnight, but I think that's where the industry is going.
And there has to be a life cycle. I mean, there definitely has to be you need to replace these devices after a period of time for the exact same reason you're talking about on device security. It's, yeah, you can't put in some sort of ICS controller out there and hope it lasts for 20 years. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. And they depreciate those devices the way they do turbines. So it's done over decades.
Yeah.
So I can understand it on a turbine, right? I got this multi-million turbine doing its thing and I want it to last 20, 30 years or more. But the Windows NT 3.51 system that has been end of life for, I don't know, 20 plus years, probably shouldn't be the thing running that multi-million dollar turbine. Because even if I just ping it, it goes, I don't know what's going on. It falls over and dies. So there's a lot of those weaknesses. I think on the OT side, that's starting to be cleaned up and there's some other compensating controls. But boy, once you get into those environments, you start looking around and you're talking to the engineers. It's pretty prevalent how risky these are. Even like industrial robots, a lot of these things ship with anonymous FTP. They're running web servers. You can actually modify the set points in the code, and you know, something that was supposed to grind a gear that's 2 millimeters thick, it makes it 2.25 millimeter thick, or does something that makes something incorrect or steal pharmaceutical data. They're just vulnerable across the board. So there's definitely not one specific device type or vendor. We see it on everything.
And I'll say that there are usually, at least in my experience, there's reasons why they have those things like open services, open ports like TFTP and FTP, because that's how they intend you update these devices.
Yeah.
That's one of the interesting things that I have found is, you know, I'll go in there with standard security processes of, all right, we're locking all this stuff down.
Yep.
And then everything breaks because they need TFTP to transfer data, or they need this service to do this thing. They do still telnet in between each other to communicate. I mean, it's really kind of scary, because as security has grown over the last 20 years and these devices have not, and I would even put it that way, because I think it's actually two different paths. You know, when we think about the desktop side, you know, laptop, desktops, mobile phones, there's been a path in which they have evolved. And, you know, they've evolved from, we had a device, it was vulnerable, we've got a patch that's fixing the new version, let's get a new version, and so on and so on. And this path has grown that way to we have what we have now. But when we're looking at the OT side, IoT side, XIoT side, that path was very different. I think is very different. That evolution is very different.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, from my perspective as a CISO, an IoT device and a laptop, I mean, they are just as equal targets for an attacker. So if they're on the network, if they have a vulnerability, if they have access to a private management network, they are just as much risk. Even though they came from different evolutions, they have different purposes, they are still just as much of a risk to the organization as the other devices.
Yeah, you're so right in that. And the interesting thing is the cyber criminals in the nation states kind of figured that out first. Offense outran defense in this case.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about Mirai. That was like the grandfather of these types of attacks. There was another attack recently called RSOCKS. So just like it sounds, letter R, S-O-C-K-S. And there was a big takedown. The U.S. and the U.K. and some other countries, we brought this down. It was a large botnet. Now, what was interesting about RSOCKS was a couple of things. The first one was it primarily targeted industrial control systems. So while it had a little bit of, you know, network devices, a little bit of enterprise IoT, it really liked these SCADA, you know, industrial control system devices, because no one was watching them. And it didn't do it to blow anything up or break anything. They weren't looking to steal intellectual property. And I will say this, something to be aware of, you know, some people don't realize this, is that when you're talking about like a pharmaceutical and how they're manufacturing a drug, or how an oil company is processing something, or how a Volvo is making a car with their robotics, all the intellectual property for that, it's not stored in some database or file server. It's actually on all these little industrial control system devices. Oh, that's the chemical in that amount mixed at this time, exposed to ultraviolet light at this temperature, cut this way, done that. That it's all there. So if somebody, that's, you know, billions of dollars in research. So there's a lot sitting on these. In the case of RSOC, so they didn't care about that. They just figured, hey, you're another internet connected device and we can add you to a bot. And it was so successful that they were actually renting it out to people. It was a Russian cybercrime gang. They were renting this out for about $30 a day. So people could do DDoS, black hat search engine optimization, phishing scams, malware distribution, you name it, anything you need a massive footprint for. And if you paid $100 a day, you got 24/7 online technical support to help you with that. So they've monetized the heck out of this stuff. And that's kind of the, you know, again, those legacy old school attacks. But then you kind of see where it's going from there. And Russia, in fact, the Russian FSB had a tool designed for them by some contractors called Fronton, F-R-O-N-T-O-N. And this was a tool that could go out, find XIoT devices, compromise XIoT devices, control those devices, and then use them to attack your IT assets, your cloud assets, other things within the environment, which seems to be the kind of the new in these attacks. It's not the XIoT device for the sake of that device, although there are some cases for that. It's actually attacking the network. Yeah. Well, unfortunately for Russia, Fronton got stolen by the Digital Revolution Hacking Group and got released on torrents all over the world. So if you speak Russian, or you can use Google's Russian to whatever language you speak, Russian to English translator, you too can have a nation state design, military grade XIoT hacking device. And it's really, really good at what it does. And they're not the only country to have that. They just happen to get theirs stolen. And the interesting thing about these is there's a lot of attacks now that are focused on, hey, if I take over your camera in executive boardroom or a manufacturing facility, I'm going to record your audio, I'm going to record your video, and I'm going to stream it out. Or I'm going to shut down your power on your UPS system, or I'm going to physically unlock doors. So there's a lot of physical kind of attacks. But I talked a little bit about before that Pivot attack. There was an attack that just came, I think it was Q1 of last year, Mandiant released it. And what Mandiant said was, there's this new attack called Quiet Exit. And the way it works was quite simple. In fact, as we talked about before, because of the low bar to hacking these devices, sometimes just logging in, the attacks are quite simple. So Quiet Exit started off with getting a user to click on a link from a phishing campaign. So it could have been email or messaging or social media. Get them to click and they get a little bit of malware on their laptop. Happens all day, every day. It's happening right now as we're talking. Now, the bad guys know, hey, we don't want to stay on this laptop because there's a lot of anti-malware and security controls. Eventually, we're going to get got, and we just don't want to stay here. So what they start doing is looking for these XIoT devices. And they go, oh, look, I found 5,000 printers and cameras over there. I found some phones and KVMs over here, HVAC system, this and that. And why pivot to one machine when I could pivot to hundreds or thousands of machines? That way, I can maintain persistence, and I can evade detection. So a lot of these network devices, of course, are BSD. a lot of the IoT systems were a lot of Ubuntu and a lot of BusyBox. And they got installed on these systems, and they loaded Cozy Bear, so a Drop Bear reverse SSH tunnel. So essentially, I get in through the laptop, I spread out to thousands of devices, install a little bit of malware. Now I have complete command and control of all these devices. Now the real attack started. What they were doing is they were making API calls to the local Exchange server and also Office 365 in the cloud. So an attack on an XIoT device can lead to IT attacks and cloud assets. They were sucking all of the email, any attachments, confidential information. They were targeting, they're doing spear phishing, going after, executives and everything they wanted. But the saddest part about this is in most cases, they were within organizations for 18 to 24 months before the first sign of compromise. And that doesn't even talk about trying to get them off the network, off of a bunch of devices that no one's been paying attention to since they were bolted into the wall 10 years ago, right? So that really adds a lot of complexity in these environments. So QuietExit, I think, was probably one of the biggest wake-up calls we've seen. And then kudos to the U.S. government. And this kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier about people standing up and saying, I'm going to take responsibility as a vendor of this or that. Sometimes that's pushed down through regulations. So in November of 2022, the U.S. government said, hey, there's a number of security cameras and devices from companies like Hikvision and Huawei that come out of the box malicious. They don't have malware on them. They are malware. They're designed to be malicious. And what these cameras would do once you install them is you say, hey, stop recording. We're not going to record because we've got a board meeting. It says, okay, I'm going to turn the green light to red. But guess what? It's still recording audio, it's still recording video, and it's streaming that off to some centralized location, right? Theoretically, China, for analysis. And they're doing pattern discovery, anomaly detection, all these types of things to kind of crunch on this data and find the little golden nuggets in these conversations and use it for whatever purposes they want. So for a couple of years, the government said, hey, these things are bad. Don't use them in government organizations. Don't use them in government contractors. I said, oh, that's probably as far as they're going to go. But in November, they actually made it illegal to import or sell. And I was pretty shocked, to be honest. I was so happy to see it. I'm like, wow, they really stepped up. And these aren't small companies, by the way. I was in Dubai about 6 months ago at this show called JITEX, which is like an RSA security conference, but like times five. I honestly think there was like over 150,000 people. It was massive. One of the biggest sponsors when you walked in was one of these camera manufacturers. I mean, you couldn't miss it. You walked, they had this thing and they're cool cameras. They're just very naughty cameras. So I was like, wow, that's a big deal. But those things are deployed all over the place. We're working with a municipal in Europe that has these cameras for a lot of their traffic systems. And there's not like hundreds of these, there's hundreds of thousands of these that they have deployed. So a lot of crazy stories like that.
Well, now that really leads into something that's close and near and dear to my heart, and that's data security. So a lot of my background is in privacy and data security. Talking about these devices, a lot of these devices have access to a lot of confidential data. You're talking about capturing the video and sending it offsite, all these audio and video and things like that. With all the new privacy laws that are coming into effect, even starting with GDPR, even though that wasn't the first, but the granddaddy, the big one, but all these privacy compliances and talking about data security, what are we seeing right now in terms of, we have, like you said, more of these IoT devices than we've ever had before. They are everywhere. I believe that is a huge privacy concern, because we don't know what's happening with that data or where it's going or what it's doing. So what is the industry thinking about that from a privacy perspective?
Yeah. They're thinking a lot about it. We probably beat cameras to death, so I won't attack them anymore. People are going to be afraid to have security cameras. So I'll pivot over to something like printers. So before, we talked about how there's about 3 to 5 devices per person in industry on average. There's a bit of a bell curve to that. So if you think about retailers, you think about industrial manufacturing, that number is a little bit higher. That might be closer to like 5 to 7, somewhere in there. Law firms, interestingly enough, are quite a bit smaller. They're more like about 1 to 3. kind of. So they're on the lower side of the curve, as one would expect. They're not the most high-tech type organizations. They don't really need to be. But something that they really rely on are their printers, scanners, copiers. That's big business. So I didn't really know this going in. I never had a reason to research it, I guess. But most of these sort of law firm grade kind of printers, they have about an 80 gig hard drive on them. So by today's standards, not huge, but not small. You can store a lot of data. And everything that's printed or scanned or copied is stored. Well, modern systems will encrypt this, and there's access control, and they do a pretty good job of managing this. But not all the printers in these organizations are modern, because they're, hey, if it's still working, why get rid of it? So bad guys know this, and you could just think of getting into a law firm, getting 80 gigs of anything they print or scan. Prudence dictates there's probably some stuff in there that is very sensitive, or a lot of stuff that's very sensitive and confidential that could be used. We see the same thing with healthcare providers and healthcare payers, like insurance companies too, where there's just a lot of printing and that type of thing going on. So in these cases, it comes back to, you're absolutely right, it's a data security issue, which is also an access control issue. So which users can get access to this? Is that access being audited? Also, when they get access to it, if somebody just rips out that hard drive and mounts it, can they just, is this just clear text? Is it just a whole bunch of PDF files that they can look at? Or is it actually encrypted? And a lot of these old systems don't. Now, we've been kind of saying bad things about XIoT, but the genie's out of the bottle. It's not going away. It's increasing at an increasing rate. And it's already outperforming, as we mentioned, cloud and traditional devices by several orders of magnitude. But I think they are doing a good job now ensuring that data, in most cases, that data in transit is encrypted and data in storage is encrypted. And there's an argument about data in use and other things. Sometimes they don't always have the horsepower to do that type of thing, especially if you start getting to some of these much smaller devices. But I think that part's been really good. The audit and logging capability and access control, that part probably isn't as good as it should be. It's great if you encrypt the data, but if you allow anonymous access to it, what's really right. The point? It's sort of like you put really, really great new tires on a car that's missing an engine. It's got nice tires, but it doesn't run. So it's kind of missing it a little bit. So there does have to be some maturation that's actually happening in terms of how these devices are being produced. And it is, I do think it is getting better, but I actually see it, the leaders in this are actually the personal home systems. So there is some overlaps. Yeah, I got a printer at home, a camera at home. I've got the same things at work, maybe different price points. But if you think about a lot of the, I look around my office and a lot of the XIoT devices, a lot of these things, you know, I click a button and it updates and it can grab it from the cloud, or it can do it automatically. You can't do that at an enterprise level. You can't be just automatically updating things because it could break something else. There has to be a little bit more care. You can't be as cavalier. If my printer goes down at home, it's a pain, but, you know, it's not going to end my world. But a lot of those systems are designed to do that. You think about like Google and Alexa and all these other types of home systems and personal assistants. They're not too bad. Roomba vacuum cleaners, LG washers and dryers, Ring doorbells. These are things that are kind of tied into that cloud, and they're not really managed that closely by the user. So if you put a good password on there, you probably don't need to change it every 90 days. I usually tell home users, you know, if you put a really good password on there, maybe you change it once a year. And that's probably good, unless you're noticing something funky happening, maybe a little bit more often on your main internet gateway, just because that's going to be your biggest point of exposure. But those devices, if you can keep them up to date with basic credentials, kind of turn off those services on those wireless access points you don't need, it kind of makes you a little bit more secure. So that thinking and that approach that's happening for the consumer level, I think is starting to eke its way into enterprises, and a little bit of a slower rate into sort of industrial control systems as well. So it's kind of interesting to see the consumer lead the fight. And I think it's because consumers are saying, look, man, this is, if I get my credit card stolen, that's one thing. But if someone's spying on my family through a camera or something, that's a different story. And, you know, I'm very sensitive about that. So I think people care and they want more security.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to, consumers have that direct impact on their daily lives. if they're in a business, they don't necessarily see that direct impact on the business unless, for instance, they're in like the security or networking or anything like that. But if they're, you know, in marketing or accounting, they're not necessarily going to see all of that like they would in their personal lives.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And I think that mentality is as more and more people become aware that these are just Linux servers and they're vulnerable like every other system, but I can't harden them and I can't secure them like traditional systems. I have to make a change. I mentioned the industrial robots earlier. I think it's kind of an interesting use case. And again, you can use it for batch or discrete manufacturing. And we did this hack, if you will. I call it a hack. But for this one industrial controller, it's about the size of a German Shepherd, but it weighs about 200 pounds. So it's not the biggest, but it's not the smallest kind of, and it was really fun to play with it, what it can do and can weld, it can poke stuff, cut stuff, grind stuff, blowtorch stuff. It's very extensible what you can use it for, mix things, everything from making a cake to painting a car, I guess. So they're really cool. You can do a lot of stuff with them. But again, they have all these configurations that are called set points. I'm going to move my arm this way, then do this, then that. And I'm, you know, it's kind of how you program it. Now, these things are controlled through three ways. One, there's a physical manual control that's actually it's wired to it. Like the old remote control cars that had a wire, you can only get about 6 feet with. So there's that. The other way are through PLCs like Rockwell, Siemens, Honeywell. These are programmable logic controllers, smart little boxes that will talk to the robot and tell the robot what to do instead of you using this little remote control. The third way is you can actually make modifications through its web server. And you can pull up a virtual version of that. It's called the pendant, these little remote controls, a virtual pendant. So you can control it online. You can actually download the configuration file via FTP, anonymous FTP. You can make modifications. You can reload it, again, anonymously. Go into the web server and tell it through the web server, hey, instead of running this file, I want you to run this file and make that the default program. And even if somebody reboots these, and these devices usually get rebooted every few weeks just to kind of reset it. It's really fast. It's like a 10-second reboot. They're super quick.
Wow.
So it's in there. Now I could change the program on the robot to just start smashing things and destroying stuff. And okay, that's pretty obvious if you're supposed to paint the door of a car, but you're punching a hole through it. Okay, that's bad. But what's really intriguing about this, what most of these manufacturers are worried about, are people getting in and one, stealing their IP. We talked about that. But two, making really small changes that might not get detected. And the story that I think about when I think about this, and I don't know, it's kind of a weird analogy, but I was in Krakow, Poland, speaking at a B-Sides event about a year ago. It was a really cool event. I said, well, while I'm there, I'm going to go ahead and take a tour of Auschwitz because I'm there and, you know, I've seen it on documentaries and things like it'll be, you know, that's kind of a sombering tour and I'll look at it. And I remember we're talking with the tour guide and they're talking about the movie Schindler's List and all these things. And there was a scene in Schindler's List where they were manufacturing weapons for the Germans, but nothing would work. So there are bullets that wouldn't fire. They were missiles that would, because everything was just offset by a little bit. So it wouldn't work. It would like jam their guns and things like that. Well, that same notion can be applied to these devices, because if you have something that's supposed to be designed to be exactly 3.5 millimeters circumference, and you made it 3.52 millimeters, it's going to pass probably a lot of the QA. And it might work in something for the first few months or the first few thousand miles, but then it's going to break, and it's going to break down that supply chain. So if that's a car or a piece of machinery, or a tank or whatever is being built, you could see how the ramifications of that could be done. If that's not just on one robot, but it's on thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of industrial control systems, the impact that could have on an organization. So that mindset and people kind of getting their arms around the impact of these little Linux servers, right? In that case, it was VxWorks, but their minds around that. That's starting to happen, and people are becoming more aware of this, thankfully, and starting to put in some compensating controls to address that. So it is happening, but it never happens as fast as we'd like. And we've been trying to do this in the SCADA world for decades, and now you're just starting to see some movement. It's kind of like turning a battleship in a pond of mud. It will happen, but you got to give it some time.
Yeah,
and you know, that sort of attack, you know, taking out something with that piece of, you know, taking out those devices. I mean, that's happened. I mean, you think about Stuxnet, think about some other things. That is a real attack that has had real consequences, that has had major impact on nations, on systems, on organizations. So, I mean, that's happening right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, the thing that it all steps back to, and we've mentioned this earlier in the conversation, is visibility. At the end of the day, many organizations just don't even know what they have. So it's hard to start. If you think about how we do it on the IT side, there's a couple ways we approach this. One, we try to scan a bunch of systems and create a database and saying, these are all our assets, Tenable, Qualys, the Rapid7, you might use tools like that to try to kind of quantify what's there. And they work really, really good for IT. They don't work great for XIoT. They're not really designed to identify them. And on the OT world, they can actually knock things over and break them. And in the OT world, availability is the key. Confidentiality, integrity, not quite as important, but literally they're keeping the lights on in some cases. So scanning doesn't usually work. So I'll sniff traffic. So, okay, I got to have a bunch of ports and taps and span ports and this and that. That can be very expensive. You could have to upgrade your infrastructure in the millions of dollars to have enough ports and taps to sniff every single segment to try to capture it. And that's really hard because we mentioned earlier, a lot of these devices are encrypted in communication. So it's kind of hard just to listen and determine what you've got out there. There's kind of a new breed of solutions out there that's really based on what's called intelligent discovery, which essentially logs into these devices, pulls out all the information and creates the data based on that. And probably the best analogy to that is C-3PO, right, from Star Wars. He spoke like a million languages, including the language binary language of water evaporators. And that is kind of what you need in an XIoT platform to be able to safely and at scale, because again, this is a scale issue because you have so many devices, communicate to all these devices and say, hey, I know what you got. And be able to tell you with 100% accuracy, hey, this is a HP printer XYZ ABC 123. And I'm not 99% sure. I'm not 50% sure. Because if I go to the next step, which is updating firmware and change your credentials and hardening it through an automated process, people get a little pissed if you turn a $2 million MRI machine into a $500 HP bubble jet printer, right? So you need that kind of exacting approach, which scanning and sniffing doesn't really provide for. So that's kind of one of the new news as it's related to that. And there's also companies out there like Sevco, and some of your listeners might be familiar with them, but the way they operate is they actually talk to all your device management systems. So from a security perspective, so they'll talk to Tenable and they'll talk to CrowdStrike and they'll talk to, you know, a Phosphorus and all these products, and they'll draw Venn diagrams and they'll say, look, you have 20,000 desktops in your environment, but you only have CrowdStrike installed on 18,000 and this installed on 16,000. It kind of shows you where the gaps are between these systems. And from a Phosphorus side, from an XIoT side. So getting that level of visibility, it seems like we've been talking about visibility since the beginning of the digital revolution, if you will. But it's just one of those things that keeps on evolving. So you have to keep on updating it. Yeah. I think companies like Sevco with this API integration and the ability to actually give you global visibility in a nice, accurate way is going to be really important for these organizations that are trying to figure out just what do I have, right? And they're not an XIoT platform. They're just a great platform for situational awareness and attack surface intelligence, if you will.
You know, from a framework point of view, having your inventory of your hardware and inventory of your software it's huge, you know. Now, from that point of view, do you think our normal frameworks that we do in security every day, so whether that be PCI framework, a PCI DSS, or the CIS-18 or NIST, or even ISO, do you think those frameworks, and I think even NIST has come out with either special publications or guidance for IoT networks, but do you think our normal processes that we do for security frameworks are still valid and useful in the XIoT space?
I do. I really do. And I think one of the things XIoT platforms are, I mean, it's a relatively new space, but they're really trying to integrate with your SIM and your SOAR and your ticketing system. So everything from Splunk to ServiceNow, Demisto, tools like this, they want to be able to plug into them. because you don't want a separate XIoT security team.
Right.
It's all part of the same framework. So if you start to break it up, you're kind of missing the value. So I do think it will work. Now there's different things, right? You can't use Tanium to do patch updates on these devices. It's just not the same thing. You're not going to deploy CrowdStrike on these because they're not going to allow it. So there's certain steps that you would have taken on IT that you can't take for XIoT.
Yeah. But
again, if you've got like a system like SEVCO, you know, cloud-based attack surface intelligence system that has visibility into all these disparate components, well, now you're in a situation where at least you have your arms around what it is that I got. And now I can start looking at things like MITRE and NIST and all these other frameworks to say, okay, how can I map it against this? Because now I have step one done, which is I've identified. It's going to change every day. So it's not like a screenshot, right? Or a snapshot. It's more like a movie. You've got to continually assess. And, oh, I just had a great Christmas, so I'm going to take in my new XIoT device that I got as a present and plug it in the office. The marketing team just bought all these new printers and gizmos, and they're going to plug those in. Well, they don't tell IT about this, right? Just like they don't tell them when they get some cloud service. So there's this constant need to continually assess, and things get moved and IP addresses change. You switch from wired to wireless, so the MAC address changes. So that's a great way to approach it. And so, yes, I guess the simple answer to your question is I absolutely do think it will apply, especially around the situational awareness. And then when you start taking preventative steps in terms of credential management and how do I integrate with a PAM or firmware management or cert management, that will take a little bit of a different angle because it's a different type of tool, but it can still be run by your security staff in, I think, pretty much every case.
Yeah, same framework, same concept, maybe different tools.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Brian, I think this has been a absolutely incredible episode. I have definitely learned a lot about the IoT and XIoT that I never knew about. Did you have any final thoughts or was there anything else that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, the last thing I'll leave with people is I don't want people to be afraid of XIoT devices and go, oh, well, the solution is to rip them out. First of all, you won't be able to. It doesn't matter if you're a healthcare provider or financial services or manufacturing. They're here to stay. In fact, they're growing. But I would say that if you get the opportunity, maybe go within your own organization, sniff around and say, hey, how are we managing this today? How are we addressing security? Most times, probably it's just not being done or it's not being done at the scale that you'd wish. If you get to that point, then maybe look into some of these platforms and some of these free tools out there that can help you discover and kind of help map that, find out where your security gaps are. And then if you get a little bit deeper, maybe you can start looking into controls that will actually help mitigate some of those risks. So it's not something that's going to be happening overnight. Be aware of it, but it all starts as, you know, with situational awareness, know what you've got, identify those gaps, and then from there you can start to take measures. And some of which, you know, might be stuff you buy, but some of which might be process changes and stuff you can do that's really no cost as well.
Well, Jonathan, Brian, thank you both so much for joining me on this episode of Secure AF. I appreciated you guys and your insight and your time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. Thanks, hey, this was a lot of fun.
Like our show? Listen to full episodes on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere else where you get your podcasts. And if you're interested in watching the video, you can find that on our YouTube or on secureafpodcast.com.